Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Anna Mateo. Later, Bob Doty, Larry West, and Tony Riggs bring us the latest in the ongoing American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, the Higher Education Report explores the issue of growing demand for mental health services at colleges and universities across the United States. More college students are turning to their schools for help with anxiety, depression, and other mental health problems. The Associated Press, or AP, reports that many students must wait weeks for treatment or find help outside the campus community as school clinics struggle to meet demand. This is just one of the findings from an AP study of over 30 public universities in the United States. Over the past 5 years, the number of students in the U.S. higher education system has changed little. Yet on some campuses, the number of students seeking treatment for mental health issues has nearly doubled. This increase has been tied to a better understanding of such issues, along with rising rates of depression and other disorders. Universities have expanded their mental health clinics, but that growth is often slow, and demand keeps rising. Long waits have led to protests at schools from Maryland to California, in some cases following student suicides. In addition, campus clinics increasingly require their mental health specialists to do more work. However, this can lead to tired, burned-out employees.
Jamie Davidson is Associate Vice President for Student Wellness at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She told the AP her school struggles with large numbers of students who need mental health help. The university has 11 trained counselors for 30,000 students, but her team still finds the work difficult. You're never going to talk to anyone in the mental health field who tells you we have sufficient resources, Davidson said. The Associated Press requested 5 years of records from the largest public university in all 50 states. A total of 39 provided year-by-year data from their counseling clinics or health centers. The records show that most universities are working to expand their mental health services, but many are simply unable to meet demand. Since 2014, the number of students receiving treatment at the universities has grown by 35%. Yet, the total number of students attending those schools rose just 5%. By last year, nearly 1 in 10 students were coming for help, but the number of trained counselors changed little. That means 1 counselor for every 4,000 students on some campuses, including at Utah Valley University. Experts suggest at least 1 mental health specialist for every 1,500 students, but few of the 39 universities met that benchmark.
When Ashton Aura sought treatment at Utah Valley's clinic last year, she was suffering anxiety attacks and had not slept for days. Her mind kept returning to painful experiences from her past. When she asked to see a counselor, one worker told her the wait list stretched for months. She left without getting help. "That was the place I was supposed to go. What do you do after that? Do you go to the hospital? Do you phone a friend?" said Aura. In the end, she turned to her religious group, which helped her find therapy at an off-campus clinic. "If it wasn't for that," she said, "I don't know." Officials at Utah Valley said they are working to avoid such cases. If officials know a student is having serious problems, they said, a counselor can see that person in a few minutes. But workers have only a brief period to make decisions about treatment. "Unfortunately, stories like this are not uncommon," said William Erb, Senior Director of Student Health Services at Utah Valley. "We train, review, and revise these procedures so that situations like this can be avoided as much as possible." At most universities, students considering suicide or facing other serious issues are offered help right away. Others are asked to make an appointment. For cases that are not urgent, the wait can last from hours to months, depending on the time of year and the design of the clinic. Many schools that provided data to the AP said it takes weeks to get a first appointment. At Utah Valley, students waited an average of more than 4 weeks last year. At the University of Washington at Seattle, it was 3 weeks. During busy times at Louisiana State University, wait times stretched to 4 or 5 weeks.
To some students, waiting is just a minor problem, but it raises the risk that some young people will give up on seeking treatment, possibly leading to a worsening of their condition. At several universities, students have organized campaigns to improve counseling services. But for mental health cases that are not urgent, some argue that waiting is not necessarily bad and could even lead to better results. A recent study found greater reductions in anxiety and depression at clinics that provide students ongoing meetings with counselors as opposed to a single meeting when conditions worsen. But under this system, the student might have to wait for a therapist's caseload to open up. The rising demand for campus mental health care has been linked to many things. Public recognition of the issue has improved, leading more students to get help. Disorders that once prevented students from going to college are no longer seen as a barrier. Some people believe social media fuels anxiety, while others say the current generation of students simply has more trouble dealing with stress. Many universities are now rethinking how they provide help, such as offering more short-term treatment programs. More students are being pushed towards group therapy or classes on dealing with anxiety. Counseling centers offer activities like yoga, and many train students to provide emotional help to one another. Rising demand has also opened doors for businesses promising solutions. Some schools work with services that provide mental health therapy over the telephone or through video meetings. Others urge students to try software programs on their smartphones. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Each week, we explore the English language. We take a close look at words and expressions. We not only define the terms, we also give examples on when and how to use them. On today's show, we talk about the word dozen. By definition, a dozen can mean specifically 12 of anything. In baking, for example, if you bake a dozen cookies, you baked 12. Most recipes for cupcakes and cookies are based on baking 12 of them. However, the amount in a baker's dozen is 13. You may be asking why. Encyclopedia Britannica explains that in medieval England, there were laws that related the price of bread to the price of the wheat used to make it. If bakers did not give their customers the correct amount, they could get fined or worse, beat. So they would bake a little extra just to be sure. Now that is a specific way to use the word dozen. But people also use the word dozen in a general way. Then it simply means a lot. So if you say you have dozens of friends or dozens of job offers, it does not mean that you have counted them, but it does mean you are pretty lucky. So those are the two meanings of the word dozen. In English, we use the word in an expression that describes something not so special. That term is a dime a dozen. This means that something is very easy to find, or ordinary. Ordinary is one of the many synonyms for dime a dozen. Something that is a dime a dozen could also be called commonplace or typical. Now, earlier I said that a dozen is 12 of anything. But with this expression, the dozen could mean a dozen of eggs. Usually, eggs are sold in a small box or container by the dozen. And buying a dozen eggs for a dime is really cheap. As you probably know, a dime is only worth 10 cents, or one-tenth of a dollar. These days, you cannot buy much with that. In fact, today, even traditional dime store candy costs more than a dime. So anything that is a dime a dozen is very common, or also very cheap. You can use the term dime a dozen for just about anything. These two friends are on vacation at the beach. Let's hear how they use this expression.
I just love the seashore. I could stay here and look at the ocean all day.
Me too. Hey, look out there. Is that a hot air balloon?
Not just one. There are many hot air balloons. It must be a race or something. Amazing.
They're going to fly by us just as the sun sets.
That is going to be breathtaking. Get your camera ready.
I can't. I'm supposed to meet a friend for ice cream.
If you go now, you'll miss the balloons flying by.
But this friend is a guy. A really cute guy.
Cute guys are a dime a dozen. But watching dozens of hot air balloons fly over the ocean as the sun sets is a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
You're right. What am I thinking? Look, here they come now.
Things that are a dime a dozen are also easy to replace. Because Washington, D.C. is such a political town, political experts are a dime a dozen. However, programs that teach American English in a fun way are not a dime a dozen. They are rare and unique. So don't forget to join us next week for another Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In any war, the enemy's capital city is an important target. To capture the enemy's capital usually means victory. In the American Civil War, the North hoped for a quick victory by capturing the southern capital at Richmond, Virginia. Northern forces were strong enough. There were about 150,000 Union soldiers in and around Washington. General George McClellan led this Army of the Potomac. It was the biggest, best trained, and best equipped of the Union armies. Larry West and Tony Riggs report on McClellan's move against Richmond.
For the first year of the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac did not fight. General McClellan kept making excuses for his failure to act. He had a plan, he said, and he would not move until he was sure his men were ready. McClellan's plan was to put his army on boats in the Potomac River. They would sail down the river to where it emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. Then he would land the boats on the coast of Virginia, east of Richmond. President Abraham Lincoln wanted to capture the Confederate capital. But he did not like the idea of moving all of McClellan's men. That would leave the city of Washington without protection. McClellan tried to calm Lincoln's fears. He said that as soon as he marched toward Richmond, any Confederate soldiers near Washington would withdraw. They would be needed to defend their own capital.
The Army of the Potomac began to move on March 17, 1862. Within 2 weeks, more than 50,000 had reached Fort Monroe, southeast of Richmond. They were equipped with 100 big guns and tons of supplies. Day by day, the Union force at Fort Monroe grew larger. McClellan had planned to move quickly to Yorktown, then push on to Richmond. He would move along the finger of land between the York River and the James River. He soon learned, however, that he could not move as quickly as planned. Heavy spring rains had turned the dirt roads into rivers of mud. McClellan's men could push through, but there was no way they could bring their big guns. McClellan decided to wait. He did not want to attack Yorktown without artillery.
President Lincoln was not pleased. He sent a message to McClellan. You must strike a blow, Lincoln said. You must act. But still, McClellan delayed. By the time his artillery had arrived and was in place, Confederate troops had withdrawn. They moved to the woods outside Williamsburg. McClellan chased them. For the first time, his army went into battle. The fighting was strange. The woods were so thick that the two sides could not often see each other. Soldiers fired at the flash of gunpowder, at noises, anything that moved. Their aim was good enough. About 4,000 soldiers were killed.
In his reports to Washington, McClellan claimed great victories at Yorktown and Williamsburg. Yet, he was worried. He believed the Confederate force around Richmond was much larger than his. He demanded more men. The Confederate force was, in fact, much smaller than the Union force. But it was deployed in a way to make it seem much larger. The trick fooled McClellan. By the middle of May, 1862, his army was only 15 kilometers from Richmond. Still, he did not attack. He continued to wait for more men and equipment. Confederate President Jefferson Davis was worried. He knew the Confederate Army was smaller than the Union Army. Davis's military advisor, General Robert E. Lee, offered a plan. Lee proposed that General Stonewall Jackson lead his army up Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. The North would see the move as a threat to Washington. Union troops would be kept near Washington instead of being sent to Richmond. President Davis agreed. Orders were sent to Jackson.
Stonewall Jackson was one of the South's best generals. He was a forceful leader, and he could make his men march until they dropped. He got the name Stonewall at the Battle of Bull Run in the summer of 1861. Southern soldiers were withdrawing. A Confederate officer tried to stop them. He urged them to follow Jackson's example, to stand and fight. He shouted, "There stands Jackson, like a stone wall." General Jackson faced three large Union forces in and around the Shenandoah Valley. Yet he struck hard and fast, and soon had control of the valley's main towns. His campaign is still studied at military schools around the world. It is considered an excellent example of how to move troops quickly to where they are most needed.
Jackson's raids produced the exact effect Robert E. Lee had wanted. Everyone in Washington feared an immediate attack on the city. Soldiers were hurried to the Capitol from Baltimore and other nearby cities. And President Lincoln sent thousands of troops to chase Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley instead of helping McClellan at Richmond. The Union Army outside Richmond was deployed on either side of the Chickahominy River. The Chickahominy was not a big river. It could be crossed easily at several places. While McClellan waited to attack the Confederate capital, heavy rains began to fall. The Little River began to rise. The commander of Confederate forces in Richmond saw this as a chance to smash a large part of McClellan's army.
The flooding river would soon cut the Union force completely in two. When that happened, the Confederates would attack. They expected to destroy at least half of McClellan's army. The plan seemed good, and after the first few hours of battle, the Confederates were close to victory. But one bridge remained over the Chickahominy River. Union soldiers were able to cross it. The Confederates were forced to withdraw to their earlier positions. No ground was gained, and more than 11,000 men were killed or wounded. Among the wounded was the commander of all Confederate forces, General Joe Johnston. General Robert E. Lee would take his place.
Lee wasted no time. He wanted to push the Union army far away from Richmond. First, however, he wanted more information about his enemy. He sent a young officer, Jeb Stuart, to get it. Stuart set off with more than 1,000 men on horseback. Theirs was a wild ride around the edge of the Union Army. When they reported back 3 days later, General Lee knew exactly where he would attack. It would be the first in a series of battles known as the 7 Days Campaign.
Lee took a big chance. He moved most of his men into position to attack what he now knew was the weak right side of the Union line. He left only a few thousand men to defend Richmond. He hoped the Union commander, McClellan, would be fooled by this plan. For if McClellan discovered how few men were left behind, he could smash through easily and capture the city. With the help of Stonewall Jackson's army, Lee's plan worked. McClellan was fooled. And after a day of fierce fighting, he was forced to withdraw from the area.
Lee chased McClellan for a while. They clashed at such places as Mechanicsville, White Oak Swamp, and finally Malvern Hill. The South won the 7 Days Campaign. The threat to Richmond was ended. The Confederacy was saved. But victory came at a terrible price. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed or wounded. As both the North and South were learning quickly, the Civil War was becoming more costly than anyone had imagined.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.